Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Ariana Pelosi. Deanna C. McFarland spoke with Boris Kisilev on the complexities of depression in patients with cancer, with the conversation centering around the confusion between clinical depression and less severe symptoms often observed in the oncology clinic. Together, the pair delved into diagnostic criteria for depression while emphasizing the continuum from normative sadness to major depressive disorder. In order to improve patient outcomes, the pair highlighted the need for oncologists to recognize and address depression.
Thank you so much for everyone listening and for Oncology for giving us the chance to do this podcast. In this podcast, we're going to be talking about depression in the cancer setting. We are going to get into the concept of cancer, what it is, what it is not, and how confusing it can be for folks outside of mental health and thinking about cancer. Like, let's think about depression for a second. As physicians, we've all gone through medical school, and we can think back to our psychiatry rotation or clerkship when we were on the inpatient psych side, and we met plenty of patients who were clinically depressed, not eating, drinking, not caring for themselves. How do you reconcile that state of depression with what we might be seeing in an oncology clinic where the patient shows up, they might be a little down, a little anhedonic, not entirely themselves, but are these entities really the same? Or is it just a matter of degree? Or is there something else going on? Does this looseness in how we talk about depression really undermine what the illness truly is and what we really mean? In psychiatry, we get very familiar and used to the way in which we talk about depression. We mean different things when we say categorical depression, or this is major depression versus depressive symptoms, which is a clue that this is not a diagnostic depression, but someone experiencing maybe a constellation of symptoms. And so I wonder, to the extent in which depression as a term kind of misrepresents what we want to communicate, especially to folks outside of the mental health areas. I will provide an example that kind of takes us from this idea of, well, we may be oversimplifying something, to a level of appreciation that kind of borders on being very complicated, mystical, and even enigmatic. One time, quite a few years ago now, I was a hemonc fellow, and I was in my attending's clinic. And this attending knew that I had trained in medicine and psychiatry. And we were in the GI clinic, and I was seeing one of his patients who had had colorectal cancer, resected, 6 months of adjuvant chemo, and was NET. So I think about this point, he was about a year from his diagnosis. His only complaint was anorexia, just a profound lack of appetite, severe weight loss, maybe about 30 or 40 pounds, and in no other way kind of matched his clinical situation, right? In interviewing him, there was nothing overtly wrong or disturbing. He didn't really think there was anything wrong. He just said, I just really can't eat. The only alarming thing to me, putting on my psychiatry hat, was his loss for words. We have a word for that. It's called alexithymia. He couldn't describe really how he felt. And I thought, is this him? You know, thankfully, he had some family members there with him, and they agreed that this wasn't really him. He had more proficiency with vocabulary than what he was presenting with. And I was certain that this man was suffering from major depression. So I said, I think we need to do something about this. My attending said, look, Daniel, you're the psychiatrist. Send him to the ED if you need to. And I walked him down. 3 months later, he came out of the psychiatric ward, and he had been given multiple medication trials and finally ECT. You know, it was in some ways a lucky guess. My risk tolerance paid off. I wasn't afraid of being embarrassed for having the wrong diagnosis, thankfully. And the patient was better off for it. But this is the point. You know, how do we reconcile, on the one hand, this kind of oversimplistic way of thinking about, yeah, when patients are sick, they're depressed, versus this kind of enigmatic thing where depression is not always easy to diagnose or to understand. So on the one hand, I can also understand the temptation to simplify because I'm also an oncologist and I see my patients presenting to me in clinic. And I've often said to colleagues that, yeah, I get it. If you told me a third to a fourth of my patients have significant major depression, I'm not sure I would believe it. And part of the reason for that, which we can get into later, is that the way that they present to the oncologist is different than how they present to Boris and to me when I'm in psychiatry. They say a lot of other things that they might not otherwise say, which is also a reason why scales tend to be very important. So on the one hand, the idea seems somewhat straightforward. Is it enough to simply know the diagnostic criteria? What else might be required? And that's where Dr. Boris is going to come in and tell us. Well, I want our listeners to come away with an appreciation for what depression is and what shapes our clinical perspectives around it. And I want to dedicate this podcast to a very effective mentor I had in psychiatry as a first-year resident. His name was Dr. Baudry at Rush University Medical Center. He was an inpatient psychiatrist, and I remember him with tremendous fondness. He made it a point for every group of medical students coming in on the psych ward to say that depression is a chameleon. I think of it a little bit like what we learn about syphilis, that it can present in all these different ways. And it requires humility and respect. Otherwise, we will miss it. It requires curiosity, self-awareness, and sometimes tenacity. We have to pay attention to those patients who are oftentimes quite difficult to sit and talk with. Depression isn't really in the patient that you want to talk to all the time. It's also not necessarily a difficult personality, but it is a depressive state, and we want to get to know it better. So, Boris, why don't we start with the diagnostic criteria? Can you provide a formal working diagnosis of depression? What are its subtypes or related diagnoses?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. And just so much there of just the things you mentioned that where this is, on one hand, you can absolutely oversimplify this topic to such a degree. But when you really delve into it, there's so much complexity. There's so much nuance. Where it can really get really tangled and stuff. And I think this will be really helpful for oncologists when they're in the clinic seeing folks and when this is such a common situation, but again, with all of the complexity of it, just having a bit more tools in the toolbox to manage it, I think is going to be extremely helpful. So basically you mentioned the idea of how do we diagnose depression? What's the criteria for that? So that's something that we're all familiar with from med school as far as our classic, we call those CGCAP symptoms of MDD, right? And so DSM-5, you need to have 5 of the 9 CGCAPS criteria: sleep, interest, guilt, energy, concentration, appetite, psychomotor slowing, or increase, and suicidal thoughts or behavior. 5 of the 9 for 2 weeks, causing clinically meaningful distress or functional impairments. If someone's had those 5 of the 9 symptoms for 2 weeks, we call that a major depressive episode. If you've had more than one of those with no history of mania, we call that major depressive disorder. But that's where kind of the nuance really starts coming in because it is so much more complicated than that. The first dimension that we can think of when we're thinking about depression is that it does exist on a continuum, right? So similar to how we think about diabetes existing on a continuum between normal blood sugar to pre-diabetes, where A1C is between that range, 5.7, 6.5, and above 6.5, now we're in diabetes. And again, of course, diabetes also can exist in a range of how high the blood sugar is, how well controlled it is. Depression's sort of similar, where we definitely have a continuum here between sub-threshold symptoms, between a normal normative response to grief and loss and trauma, like people are experiencing during cancer, and obviously to actually what we call MDD or major depressive episode and obviously gradations there. I think it's helpful to think about where this continuum is starting is sort of what we call this non-pathological or what we might call normative sadness. The idea of anytime you experience some challenging news, you experience traumatic event or something like a cancer diagnosis, you're gonna have a normal reaction to that. You're gonna experience feelings and emotions and a reaction, and that's normal and that's actually healthy, right? So the emotion of sadness is not a bad thing. It's not something pathological, and it's something that's part of our human experience, and it's there. It's giving us information. It's telling us this is something that's happening in my life that I need to bring awareness to, that I need to be aware of, and that I need to do something about. So the emotion of sadness is not a bad thing. It's not harmful, and it's something that we want to have access to and be able to experience. And in fact, trying to avoid experiencing the sadness grief may actually not be adaptive or helpful, right? So we call that normative sadness. What does that sort of look like? The best way to really think about it is, what does that lack compared to what does depression have, right? So, and those are the things. So normative sadness, again, we're going to have, might have sad feelings. We might feel kind of down at times, but the idea is that those feelings are coming on in response to our thoughts about the situation. It's sort of waxing and waning. They're coming in waves, but then they're going away other times. The important thing is that it's not affecting our functional abilities. We're able to spend time with our families, go to work, do the other things we usually be able to do. Our functioning is not affected by this emotional process, right? We're still functioning. And we're also lacking some of the other symptoms of depression, which I'll kind of get to. And then the other kind of thing to notice too about, we call it normative sadness, is that it's something that improves over time, right? We're going to have this reaction that's normal over a period of days, weeks, maybe a month or two. We should be seeing it getting better, because that's sort of our normal grief reaction, that we're going to experience that feeling, we're going to process it, and we're going to make some changes and or make some steps forward in our life.
Right? Horace, I want to interrupt you for a second, because I love that you brought up grief. And I find that I use this term all the time with patients, and it resonates with them. So the grief is their pre-cancer self. The grief is the job that they're not able to do, or the social relationships that they're not able to have, or that have been strained by this. And so they really get it that this is grief. And that's another human experience that we can relate to. And so we know grief comes in waves. We know it's almost cathartic when you cry. I love the question I'll ask, you know, when you have a good cry, do you feel better, or do you not? And when they don't, I'm more concerned. When they do, I'm saying this is grief. And so that's, we love this word appropriate, don't we? So that's appropriate, because it's a change. The other thing about functionality that I love you were getting into, it can be very nuanced, right? So you've got a business executive, right? And what does it take for them to be functional, or someone who doesn't have as many obligations, et cetera. But I always like this sort of continuum of, like, there's suffering, because you have people who are quite resilient, who can take on a lot of suffering and still function fairly okay, right? And then some people who aren't and won't be functioning very well. And so, like, that's really important, especially for folks who are able to kind of keep it together, but they're really, really suffering. So I always keep that in the back of my mind as a little caveat to the functionality portion of it, because if they're very resilient, they may be functioning and holding it together, but suffering a tremendous amount. So
100%. Yeah, no, I love that you kind of brought up the idea of grief, because I think that it's a word that fits when you start describing this experience to patients. They really resonate with that. And again, so many things that have lost, and the idea too of a lot of times, especially for our younger patients that may have never had a major medical issue like this before, they're grieving like that sense of self and their view of their mortality. Because before you have a diagnosis like this, especially if you're a young person, you're not thinking about your mortality. Now you're grieving like this, the way that you could used to be able to even see the world, because now it's been fundamentally changed, right? Describing it as a grief, acknowledging there's loss, I think is really helpful for patients to normalize some of their experience and to put words to some of what they're experiencing. The point meant there was the idea of between the distress and the functional impairment, that's why DSM says either one, right? Because you might have no functional impairment, but have severe distress. Or it might be the other way around, where you're not experiencing as much the depression or as aware of the distress, but suddenly, like, you're barely in the bed, you're barely functioning at all. So it's why it says either one of those, because if you have one of those caused by the symptoms, that's part of the criteria. We need to have distress or functional impairment. And again, it can be more one or the other. So something if you're functioning perfectly, doesn't mean that things are just fine. That kind of goes to the next thing too, of how do we delineate? We might have what we call normative grief with more of a depressive episode, more of an adjustment, or more of something going on, right? So, and I think I'm going to list off a couple, and these are just the ones that I'm thinking about when I'm seeing somebody to really kind of tell, right? The first one I'm thinking about is anhedonia, right? And that's what we think about anhedonia thing is that loss of interest or pleasure in our previously meaningful and positive experience. So this is a sense of like things I used to enjoy doing just don't feel pleasurable, don't feel good to me anymore. I'm not motivated to do the things that I used to be able to do. So, and this is one where it can be helpful to ask the person, like, what are some of the things you used to enjoy doing? Like, what did you used to enjoy doing? And are you still wanting to do that stuff? And even sometimes they have to be impacted by certain elements of the treatment. So, you know, perhaps they have some shortness of breath, they can't walk, but are you still able to spend time with your family? Are you still able to read a book or do things that you used to like, or just not motivated to do that stuff? Let's hear about that. Cause that's a major effect on their quality of life. Cause the things they used to enjoy doing, they're just not positive. And I think that's definitely a key part of depression. It's not just the feeling sad. It's the sense that even if I do something that I might want to do, it doesn't feel pleasurable. So I can't get out of that sad feeling. And again, that's unlike normative sadness where I might feel sad and down, but hey, when I kind of connect with people I care about, when I'm having those times, the things that are meaningful to me, I'm still able to experience joy and pleasure, right? The next one for again, kind of delineating out a normative reaction versus more of a disorder or something to be addressed would be feelings of guilt or worthlessness. Right? So that's, again, one of those seed caps. But the idea that someone that's going through a normal normative sort of reaction shouldn't have this extremely new and changed negative sense of self, right? So a common thing we'll see folks that are quite depressed with their cancer diagnosis, they might start really blaming themselves for the diagnosis and it might even be in a way that's not even, you know, fully accurate. Or it may be say they were, you know, a smoker or something like that, but they are so focused on that now and they can't get rid of this guilt and this sense of that they've done something irreparable, you know, to harm themselves. And there's often also worthlessness is the other one. So a common thing to, you know, is patients might describe like feeling like a burden on the people around them, that they're needing more care, or they might feel like, hey, I used to have these things, these responsibilities, I can't do them. And as a result, now I'm feeling worthless. So it's the idea that their self-esteem has just been massively affected by this, which again, we shouldn't expect that in what we call a more normative type of reaction. And that kind of ties into the next part too, which is again, with more of a depression, we're going to be seeing some change in someone's sense of identity, right? So if we're experiencing grief reaction, we'll still feel like ourselves, but when we're experiencing depression, we often don't feel like ourselves. So patients will even say, I just don't feel like myself. And a lot of times, you know, and that's a lot of times how I'll describe the goal of the treatment. You know, when I'm talking about a treatment, I'm going to say the goal of this treatment is not to get rid of anxiety or to eliminate the anxiety or to eliminate these feelings, because like we talked about, the feelings are normal and the feelings themselves are maybe giving us information. Well, we can't eliminate the feelings. The goal is to help us to function better and to feel like a regular self again. So that's how I kind of frame the goals of treatment is we want you to feel like your regular self again. We might still have worrying. The goal is not to eliminate the worrying because we can't do that, but the goal is to help you to function and feel better. And again, that idea of feeling like you're yourself, you know, that getting your identity more aligned with what you're used. And again, some of it might also be related to those losses, right? Or I can't work anymore. I can't function the same way at home. And that can be really challenging and contribute to sort of identity challenges. And then the next couple ones. So one is a big one also is a sense of hopelessness or helplessness, right? So if you're experiencing a normal reaction to a loss, you'll still have some sense of hope for the future, right? Even if you have a cancer that's not curable, you'll still have hope for time. You'll have a hope for being able to do certain things. You'll have certain goals and things that you're hoping for, right? But if you start losing that hope, that why even go on with this treatment? Because I don't even see the point of going on, right? That's a red flag of, okay, well, is there some hopelessness there? That sounds a bit more of like depression, right? And same with helplessness, right? So recognizing that in the cancer setting, there are so many things outside of the patient's control, which is a major, again, kind of going to that sense of grief. It's like, I've lost the sense of control. But part of what we want to do is maintain some sense of control in our life, right? And if we have a complete loss of sense of control, that kind of goes in that helplessness. And that, again, is a red flag. Maybe there is more of that depression going on.
Boris, to that point, I have to say, I often ask how the patient is doing with their oncology team, how they feel about the oncology team. Because if you think about it, when someone's diagnosed with cancer, they go through this experience of a workup, a lot of doctors telling them that they just have a cold or something else, right? And then finally the diagnosis comes and it's in the middle of the night, an intern comes and lays the diagnosis on them. And it's frankly, oftentimes a totally traumatic experience. And then finally, they make it to see an oncologist, surgical, radiation, medical oncologist, who basically lays out this phenomenal plan of, hey, we got all the information, we're going to do this. And you know what? The patients feel so much better because finally they've met someone who understands what's going on and they have a plan in place. And once they start treatment, they start interacting with the infusion center or all the other people that are involved, the ancillary staff, everyone around knows what's going on with their situation, who's sympathetic to what's going on in their situation. And, you know, just part of human nature would sort of dictate that, like, that kind of coziness, we should make you feel better, you know, and it should provide hope. Now, everyone has a different, what we call like attachment system, right? And so some people just don't attach very well. Most people have a pretty secure attachment, actually. That goes along with this kind of idea of hope. You know, at least my team's got my back. They're treating me well. So whenever I hear someone's feeling kind of a little funny about that business, I get really concerned. And it's for that reason about hope. You kind of have an N of one situation too, don't you? So it's really important to have the patient compare themselves. You know, you don't know them from before. And so it's like, yeah, is this how you were before? Because there's some people who are just a little what we would call dysthymic, right? They just kind of run that way. And you don't want to pathologize, but, you know, so anyway, just go on. I just wanted to make that point.
I think that's so crucial. That's one of the probably amazing things of working oncology is the connection that the patients have with their oncologist. It's so just deep and personal. Also, too, one of those things where it's not an uncommon thing in the story where sometimes where the diagnosis, it's taking a second, you know, to kind of, especially more younger patients, again, that maybe people aren't expecting this, and it takes some time to get that diagnosis, and that kind of contributes to that worrying because, gosh, this was missed for X amount of time, and they thought it was this, they thought it was that, and that kind of contributes to then those worries of, well, is there anything else being missed, and is there something that's not going on, and so on, and those sort of worrying thoughts people can have when they're ruminating.
Boris, one other thing I wanted to say that it's interesting when you talk to folks in the throes of cancer and dealing with it, and they're finally kind of getting set up. And they start talking about how it is that they're interacting with other people outside of oncology. I think it's really interesting because if you think about the reactions that most people have, they're dour, they're down, they're sad, they bring out feelings. And so one of the things that's so lovely about patients within our cancer center and dealing and sort of the benefit and the effect that we can have on them is that we're not, right? Like we're a little upbeat, you know, hopefully not pathologically so, but that's exactly why it works, is because people don't want to be seen as their cancer. They don't want to be a reminder of mortality for everyone else. They want to be, you know, Bob or Sue or whoever they are. And that is frankly how we treat them, hopefully, because we've seen lung cancer. We've seen that. And to us, they're not their lung cancer. They are who they are. We need to be somewhat optimistic about our treatments, about what we're doing, right? And obviously real at the same time. And this dance can be very interesting. One of the things that can happen is that patients, they come in to see the oncologist. They know that the oncologist is going to give them the treatment. They need the treatment to get better. And so there can be a little bit of a dance. So you don't often know what you don't know, right? Like you can't often see that, okay, there's something else going on, because in my experience and being in both oncology and psychiatry, this is clear as day to me, because when I'm sitting in a group of patients and we're talking about their experience, they're saying all kinds of different things that I never hear in my oncology clinic, you know? And I came to realize that it's partly about, they know what the agenda is. They know what's supposed to happen. They know what's at stake, you know? So there's nothing really wrong with that. It's just sort of the way that it is, but it also should give us pause and make us sort of, you know, think about what these other issues might be. It's also one of the reasons that scales are so important. We don't use enough of them, frankly. They mean a lot. And so when you look at the data and you look at outcomes, these outcomes that say, hey, the patient with depression and lung cancer doesn't do as well as the patient who has lung cancer without depression, they're based on standard scales like the PHQ-9 or something, or some other scale that just looks at depressive symptoms, not diagnoses of depression. So that actually kind of is a little daunting, but it also means that, hey, what we're talking about is really important, because the bottom line is that getting a hold of the depression early on really has tremendous benefit for patients. So I had this really cool example of, you know, what happens when you see a mannequin and you're thinking, okay, that's a real person, right? And then all of a sudden you realize, no, it's a mannequin. So you have this idea of like yourself being seen, right? And so you suddenly realize like your subjective is no longer subjective, it's also objective. But it's like taking that lens of your perspective and then realizing there's another perspective looking at your perspective. So it's kind of a fascinating thing. But I think that that's what happens a lot of times when we're thinking about depression and cancer. And so in an oncology clinic, we have our perspective and we know our patients, but there's another side to them that we really don't know. And I could say with some authority, being in both places, that that is really truly the case. We don't know this other side. And it's often the more intimate kind of personal side that patients very appropriately want to kind of shield from their oncologist. So oncologist is the one who's saying yay or nay to treatment. Mm-hmm. You're talking life or death. It's big time stuff. Mm-hmm. And it is a fully intimate, important relationship. But like every relationship, there are some bounds and some limits to it. And so this is one of them that this is my little soapbox because I've come to experience it firsthand and think that it's really interesting. I think it's also the reason why there's confusion around this topic sometimes.
That's so interesting. What it reminds me of is like, it's like a quantum theory. If you observe like the electron, like that alters like how the electron, whatever it is.
Exactly.
So it's like, we're trying to get a sense of what the patient's like, but the patient by being in the clinical setting of interacting with us is going to be not acting like how they usually are. Cause it's like such a foreign environment. And that in action, that will be different again in an oncology clinic because they know they need this treatment, right? So they're going to maybe try to present as, hey, I'm doing great. Things are okay. Because like they don't want something to be changed with that. And they want to kind of maintain that. And that's also where it's challenging for some, maybe sometimes for oncologists to maybe be as even aware of it because they're not, the patient's trying to maybe not, is either consciously or unconsciously not expressing some of these things because they don't want something to be changed with their treatment. They don't want that.
You know, no, you're exactly right on. And I love the quantum physics example because yes, once you introduce, and we know this from psychiatry, right? That patient comes in, what's the very first thing that you say to them, right? Well, hello, because we're two human beings in a room, but do you ask them about what happened before? Do you ask them what's going on now? Because it's very important what they bring up. So once you start interjecting and asking questions, you've already set it up. So there's we're not doing their agenda, we're doing your agenda. We both have agendas, right? And one of the things it's, you know, Boris and I have gone back and forth between medicine and psychiatry. And I'll never forget, I was on my palliative care rotation one time as a hem-onc fellow. And the attending said to me, Daniel, we did this family meeting and he let me lead the meeting, right? And he said, I was scared. I didn't know what you were doing in this family meeting. The reason was because we walked in and I just let the patient and the family go and talk because as you know, they give you a lot of information and it's really interesting to see where they go. And then we have the comfortability to know that, hey, we're going to rein them back in and we're going to get to where we need to get to. Because once you, and this is one of the big differences between medicine and psychiatry. We know in psychiatry, we've got to let them go. We've got to see where their mind goes. We've got to understand without, quote unquote, polluting, you know, the environment. We've got to let them just sort of do it free rein for a little while. And then we'll come in and we'll be directive. And so I've sat through so many ICU meetings and things like that where I'm like, oh, I just wish that the patient and family had 5 minutes to just go, right? Because it's so rich if you can do that. But I think there's always a fear that they're going to go in a direction and I don't want them to go in that direction. And what if they do? And can I get them back? Yes, you can get them back. You're the one with the white coat on. You know, you can say, you can direct it. But it takes some comfortability, doesn't it? So.
100%. That's a common thing where I'm working with learners, whether it be residents or students, where I'm encouraging often like, hey, let's start out the interview as open-ended as possible. Let's like, and I think especially in our oncology setting, it's so helpful, I think, for patients to share their experience. And so just to go through what this was like over time, I'll often give them kind of as much time as they need a little bit to just sort of talk about that, to sort of see where they go. And that one is just helpful, I think, for them to be able to, because sometimes those type of things, they might have even felt comfortable to share that whole experience with somebody. And also for them to put those elements in order. Okay, this is what happened first. And this is what happened second. This mm-hmm. is how I dealt with that. And often, I think going back to another thing you said earlier is that moment of when they're told a diagnosis. And I think this is something that every single patient just has that memory so far mm-hmm. in their mind. And I think that's how that is delivered, I think is so So it's just, that's something if someone's going to remember for the rest of their life, basically. So that's another kind of just maybe thing to kind of put out there too, is when we're hearing folks, I almost always hear, this is how it was told, or this is how it happened, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's a great point, Boris, because one of the things in my psych clinic, I want them to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
But we in oncology can do that too. We have all the information, right? But you can make a choice. You don't have to go in and say, okay, well, the scan said this and you have this pathology. Let's talk about the plan, right? Let them tell the story. Let them go through it. Feel where are the pressure points? You know, what went wrong? What went right? Then they feel like you know them because you've heard their story. And so I had another attending in Hemong Fellowship, and I love this, that she, oh man, we did not like rotating with her, but I'll tell you why. Because when she came on the rotation, the first day was like a 12-hour day. And she just wanted the her husband was a psychiatrist, so she really knew this stuff. So she said, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to go all in on what's happening with patient, you know, X, Y, and Z, and we're going to just get it all out. And oh boy, did that make such a difference. And her rate of getting patients in and out of the hospital was great. Patients felt heard. There wasn't a lot of issues. And it's just, that's what you're talking about, Boris, is you do a little bit more work on the front end and it pays dividends on the back end. And that's the bottom line, because we can't tell you how much of like what we call like acting out, or am I getting enough attention? There's all these ways that people do this kind of stuff. And it's like a power struggle sometimes. We don't have enough time, right? You just give them the time. They know you're under pressure. Give them the time. They feel so like respected, so much dignity there. It pays off in the end. And so I know we're getting a little off topic of the depression thing, but it's very good stuff. And so it's all related, because the bottom line is that your relationship as an oncologist is therapeutic. There's just no doubt about it. And so these are the tools that you need to use to kind of have that. You don't even need, I mean, you can leave it to us to write the Zolpidem and the citalopram and, you know, all the fancy stuff, right? But it's the relationship. It's the relationship. And I think you probably relate to that, Boris. Oftentimes we're filling in that relationship to some degree.
100%. And I think too, going back to that question you mentioned of asking the patient, how are things going with oncology? How is that going? Anytime I hear that, hey, like I'm feeling really good about it. Things are going super well. I feel really well supported. That tends to be a really positive, like I know that, hey, this person, we're going to be able to kind of, things are going
to
work out.
You can move on to the next person now, right?
It's like, maybe there's some things to optimize, but I know that things are going to be, and also your other point of spending that time up front. And I think part of that is systemic challenges, other challenges where people may feel pressured for time, or again, patients in a lot of distress can be just challenging. Like you mentioned earlier, it's difficult how we're feeling, spending time with that.
Absolutely.
That's creation that causes it's, we were with an anxious person, we feel anxious. That's normal, right? Human reaction, right? So
With depressed person, and we feel depressed and we kind of want to leave because we don't feel that good, right? And
exactly.
Let's get on to the next one.
Okay, I did want to mention a couple last things. So these are, I think we're on the symptoms of depression to kind of tell, right? The two other big ones I wanted to talk about. One was basically thoughts of death or suicide, especially, mm-hmm. you know, if someone's having passive thoughts of just thoughts of not wanting to be alive anymore, that's a red flag that, you know, that's more a normative reaction. Another one is like the nerve vegetative and physical symptoms of depression. And those are kind of what the RSA caps. That's, I'm not hungry, I'm not sleeping, I'm tired, that sort of thing. So those would be the symptom clusters we talked about. We talked about anhedonia, guilt, worthlessness, identity, hopelessness, helplessness, death, suicide, nerve vegetative symptoms. Again, those being the depression ones that separated out from more normative mm-hmm. reaction.
Yeah, that's complicated when they're on treatment, right? And then their energy's low, they don't have an appetite, all of that. And you know, I often go to the like, how do you feel about yourself? And are you forward thinking? We actually have different criteria, but we don't really use them very often, like the Endicott criteria and all mm-hmm. that. Let me ask you, Boris, just to summarize, because SigiCaps, we all learned it in medical school, but it's a wonderful tool and friend. But the point is that actually some of those symptoms are a bit more complicated than you might think, especially in any medical setting, frankly. But it's not so much as going with your gut, right? You've got to you need your gut to some extent. It's fair to have these criteria in the back of your mind, understand what the time period, the 2 weeks is, understand their previous psychiatric struggles, if there were any, to get that collateral information. Let me ask you, because I brought up at the beginning about this phenomenon of, hey, my patient's doing well oncologically, they're not depressed, they're not doing well, they have regression on their scans, yeah, they're depressed. What do you think about my little oversimplification here?
Yeah, I think it's one of those challenges where I wish it was that simple, right? Where we get the disease better and the person.
But we'd be out of a job if it was that simple, Boris.
I will say it's a very common referral we get is someone that's 3 to 6 months out of treatment. The treatment went great, but now they're experiencing depression or anxiety or all these symptoms they're coming. And this is an extremely common referral. And there's like a number of different factors that kind of come with that. So the first one is the idea that again, going back to that grief process, right? A lot of times during the actual treatment, patients are just trying to get through the day. They're focused on getting through the treatment. They may not be spending the time to really be processing this experience and what it means for them. This is going to change so much of their life, their view of mortality. And often, even after the treatment, there often are some sort of side effects or something that's sort of going on afterwards, whether that be just scars they have to deal with or changes in their body, or maybe neuropathy or some fatigue or some other changes or symptoms that they still have, right? So the idea is that once they're through the treatment, during the treatment, they're getting a lot of support, right? They're seeing the oncologist, they're calling the nurse, they're coming in for infusion. They're having all these people around them that are rallying and supporting them through that. Afterwards, there's often the sense of, oh, okay, well, you're done with the treatment now, go back to life. And often that's not so easy because their life has been sort of fundamentally altered and everyone around them maybe isn't, basically the their family, other folks around there may want to just kind of get them back to where things were just so that they can not have that habit, think about,
I often say it's a suggestion of love that they want the best for them, right? Mm-hmm. But it feels very much, it's like the difference between like sympathy and empathy that, It's not them. It's like the person's not understanding where they are. And what you're saying, Boris, is that we see so many patients whose cancer status is good or NED or what have you, or their, stable disease if it's metastatic setting, but they're just starting to grapple with it. So the depressive symptoms might be reactive, like we say, they have a major depressive disorder, right? So it kind of stands in contrast to this idea that like, well, it's just sort of symptom-based from their cancer. Certainly when folks have progressive disease, they're fatigued, they don't feel good, et cetera. So that looks a lot like depression. On the other hand, you and I know that we talked about sadness and that can be appropriate. And that's a lot of times what's going on. It's hard for the oncologist as well to deal with their own patient who's progressing. We have a lot to learn from patients who confront death in all different types of ways. They're not always depressed. That's just the bottom line. We say this must be depressing, and it's an unfortunate thing that we say. It must be sad, I suppose. But oftentimes these patients aren't depressed. And that's kind of, I mean, I think it's good that we try to make sure that they're not, but there is that reality. So it's on both sides, it's more complicated than just the fact is that if it was as simple as, well, their cancer is progressing, then all we have to do is treat the cancer. And so then that's it, I suppose. But anyway, it's an important point because we don't want to oversimplify the state of depression, either depressive symptoms, because they translate into oncologic outcomes and there are effective treatments. Tell me, Boris, one other thing I think we should get onto is about depression and anxiety. How do you deal with that? A lot of patients who will say, I'm not depressed, but I'm anxious. And similarly, oncologists will say that, probably because of everything we just talked about in terms of how difficult it is to diagnose depression. Anxiety is ubiquitous and it's uncomfortable. So people talk about it much more. And it's in a way a little bit more accepted to talk about, right? What do you make of the relationship?
100%. Fantastic question. Again, it's sort of like this depression anxiety dichotomy. So one thing sort of to think about here is the idea that it's actually interesting going back through, if you go through a history DSM, that concept of anxiety as like a separate thing is actually a bit new. That's only since DSM-4. Back in DSM-3, basically there was a rule that if you had a mood disorder like depression, you couldn't even diagnose a comorbid anxiety disorder, because a lot of times they would just say, just treat the depression. The anxiety is related to that. And that's been changed now with more recent DSM. But I do think there's some truth to the idea that a lot of times depression and anxiety, these things are extremely commonly going together. And like you mentioned too, I think it's a lot more often easier for patients to talk about feelings of anxiety or worrying for whatever reason than it may be for symptoms of depression. So a lot of times, if someone's presenting with anxiety and worrying, we certainly want to ask about that, hear about that, what's that experience like? But we also want to take a second and triple check, what is their mood like? Are they having any symptoms of depression? A lot of times, if you start digging, they will start mentioning like, yeah, like I'm super worried. And yeah, it's hard for me to enjoy stuff because I'm really worried. And I'm not motivated to do stuff I used to do because I'm so worried. And yes, I'm having trouble sleeping because I'm worried. And gosh, like I feel really down and I actually feel really bad that I'm worrying so much. And so all of a sudden, you've got all the symptoms of depression, even though it's in the context of also this anxiety, right? And for better or worse, at least, we do know that a lot of the treatments we're going to use for depression or anxiety are kind of the same treatment. We're using antidepressants, we're using therapy or combination. So it is helpful to kind of tease out which is a bigger complaint so you can be maybe a bit more targeted. But the biggest, I think, thing is that if someone's experiencing anxiety, reporting anxiety, that's another kind of yellow or red flag to say, let me just triple check, is there some depression going on? Because more often than not, there really often is. And oftentimes, you will get both better at the same time. So if you can get a treatment that helps both depression and anxiety, it's going to improve both. Versus, I think sometimes the approach, if they're super anxious, let me give them a benzodiazepine or something that's going to just get rid of anxiety, but it doesn't address the depression. And oftentimes, then they'll still have functional impairment, they still have symptoms, and it's not actually all the way getting better.
That's a great answer. I kind of prioritize the depression and think about it in terms of, and actually it's the same with the outcomes. Anxious states don't translate into worse outcomes, but depression does. And so I think of it like kind of what you mentioned with the benzodiazepine. You know, maybe you do a trial of some treatment, the patient with depression is probably not going to respond all that well, right? And so you know, it's kind of a matter of triaging in a sense and how you think about them and kind of the appropriateness around it. Were you going to go on to say something else for us? Or?
I think that was kind of it as far as anxiety. That's the main thing I think about is certainly that we want to hear about the experience, but to triple check for how their mood is doing.
There's so much more to talk about with depression. We have differential diagnoses, right, to think about. I love that you brought up this historical idea of, you know, all the different iterations of DSM. They all bring something different, a lot of them flawed, but a lot of them very rich with clinical ideas and information. That's another thing to kind of keep in mind. I think the main issue is that depression is something to, like I was saying at the beginning, it's just something to kind of have a very like humble respect for. When it's there, it's a really big deal. What would you say the mimics of depression are? Like, what is the differential of depression?
Yeah, 100%. So, and I think that's another good thing about it, is just because we're thinking about depression symptoms, it's very helpful. We want to maintain that differential diagnosis and thinking through kind of the main differential. So again, I'll kind of split this up into kind of the basic one. The first one I always kind of mention is actually going to be delirium. So delirium is one of the biggest mimics of depression, especially in an inpatient setting, especially in a hospital setting. There's a study where they just looked at consults to a CL psychiatrist service for depression in one hospital. And the rate of times when that was actually delirium, not depression, was something like 40 to 50%. So a lot of the times, and again, you think about what delirium does, your brain isn't just good for serial sevens and remembering what year it is. It helps with regulating and managing your mood and your affect. So someone that's having hypoactive delirium may often have apathy, withdrawal. They may be crying. They may not be doing stuff. They may not be talking as much, right? But we want to separate that out because the treatment is very different, right? Delirium, we don't want to be starting antidepressants for delirium. We want to be find the underlying cause, address the underlying cause. And in fact, adding a lot of psychotropics may exacerbate things. It may not be helpful. So that'd be number one, is just triple checking, is there delirium present? And last thing I'll mention on that is not just orientation questions, but asking about those tests of sustained attention, your serial sevens, world backwards, three-word recall, that sort of thing, because that is what delirium is. It's a disorder of attention and arousal. The next one I'll mention, it would be substance-related disorders. So I'll mention the idea of, you know, alcohol use, you know, substance use, cannabis, all these things, right? Those certainly can contribute to mood anxiety symptoms, and it can be difficult to treat a mood disorder if there's a really, really high amount of active substance use. The next one would be like a bipolar disorder. So we know that major depressive episodes are characteristics of MDD, but they're also characteristic of bipolar disorder, where you have major depressive episodes and you have mania or hypomania. And so anytime you're going to add an antidepressant, you want to be screening for a history of mania in a patient, because we know antidepressants, you know, one can trigger mania or mixed states, or they may just be helpful for patients with bipolar disorder. So that'd be better kind of differential.
Or steroids can trigger it, right?
Oh, and there are steroids, right? And that's not uncommon one as well, where we'll find out after the fact, oh gosh, this is a bipolar illness because they got steroids and gosh, like there was this, they had this really bad reaction. And a couple other I'll mention on differential here. One would be trauma / PTSD, right? Recognize either that be related to prior trauma or some traumatic experience that happened during their treatment. The idea being that trauma and PTSD are often comorbid with depression, but a lot of times if we're having a lot of those what we call trauma-related symptoms, things like flashbacks, nightmares, hypervigilance, avoidance of traumatic triggers, the treatment for that tends to be a bit more aggressive on the therapy side, because we think of medications as not quite as disease modifying for the trauma related symptoms as is, you know, psychotherapy and specifically a trauma focused therapy. So we want to keep that on a differential and ask about those trauma related symptoms. And if we're feeling that might tip our scales and really encouraging a patient towards therapy. And the last one I'll mention on differential would be basically dementia or neurocognitive disorders. It's another common referral I get. Patients withdrawn, they're not doing much, they're sort of apathetic. And then we do a MoCA on the patient and it's like, you know, 20 out of 30. And they're having these subtle declines in their functional performance and their IADLs. And this, again, where things can get really challenging in oncology because one, you know, first of all, if someone's very depressed, they can have what we call pseudodementia, which is those cognitive symptoms of depression. Two, a lot of times before someone's diagnosed with dementia, they may have premorbid depression that occurs in those years beforehand at the higher incidence. And if they're getting cancer treatment, a lot of cancer treatments can affect your cognition, you know, right? Chemotherapy and other things, right? So that's where things can get really complex. And that's where if you're unclear, you're wondering about a neurocognitive disorder, having neuropsychologists available to help with that referral. And I'll put that out too. If you're ever in a situation where you're really wondering about the differential, is it depression, is it something else, and you're not sure, that's a fantastic time that is great to loop in a therapist or a psychologist or psychiatrist or another mental health provider, because this differential is challenging. It's not, I will not say it's so easy for me when I'm seeing a patient, for me to be able to say, this is exactly what's going on. Oftentimes we have a couple things in mind. We have a couple things we're working on. So it can get sort of complex, especially on like a bipolar disorder, which is both overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed at the same time. It can be really difficult to tell what's kind of going on.
I would say also just the medical issues of hypothyroidism, especially with all the immunotherapy we're giving, adrenal insufficiency, great differential. Thank you so much. We're kind of up on the hour here, and you know, great to meet you and get to know you, Boris. Thanks again for the opportunity to do this podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. This was just, I had so much fun just talking with you, and so such a rich topic, and just appreciate your time.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook at Cancer Network without the O, or on LinkedIn at Cancer Network.